tune out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Tuesday, the 14th of July, 2026, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say we have a special guest with us today. It is that time again when a new issue of Heritage and Destiny hits the shelves, or hits the letterboxes, as it were, issue number 132, and I'm very pleased to say that we have the assistant editor of H&D with us here today, Mr. Peter Rushton. Peter, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Very good to be here, Sven. Thanks very much for the invitation. I'm very well.
I do enjoy our conversations, our bi-monthly conversations, when the new issue comes out. I'm about two-thirds of the way through it, and it's up to its usual high standards of literary quality and journalism, I guess you would call it. I think you're an exceptional journalist yourself, Peter. And
Thanks very much, sir.
Yeah, I know you're very well educated, and it comes across in your writing, and you're very thorough as well. And the first bit that really sort of hits you about this month's issue is the movement news about the election, because, of course, we recently had the election of a new prime minister in Makerfield, and I think we also had these by-elections as well. I think they might have been covered in this issue as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, your first piece in this month's issue, Peter?
Yes, well, it's sort of in the nature of this particular issue of H&D. We've also always got a certain amount of updates on local by-elections and things, but that's normally quite a modest amount of the magazine. In this particular issue, just because of the course of events, the course of quite dramatic events, elections and discussion of electoral politics takes up quite a large amount of this particular issue, because of the high drama of what happened in Makerfield following so soon after the local elections earlier this year. And I think we were what I was trying to do in that article was to pick up what seemed to me to be the beginning of a trend of events. Now, it might be a little bit too early to say, but I can discern, and I think a few nationalists can discern, the beginning of the end of the era when Nigel Farage was absolutely at his peak and seemed to be about to, you know, become a future prime minister. It looks as though the shine has come off Farage now. People are, a lot of people well beyond our own ranks are starting to look rather more sceptically at Farage. And that, of course, is why Farage himself has now called yet another by-election stunt in his own constituency of Clacton. But preceding all of that, Makerfield was arguably a turning point when you could begin to see some of the problems with the whole reform project, and you could start to see some of the reasons why people were looking for alternatives to it, especially people who've been around nationalism for a long time. So that was the background to the article about elections, the idea that that reform's failure to win Makerfield, and failure by such a big distance, that was the important thing, started to show that what had seemed to be the case at the local elections, this great surge of support for reform, was fading pretty badly. and that that even those who were prepared to go a little bit quiet on nationalist principles, shall we say, in order to have a chance at power, even people who want to go down that route are now starting to look askance at the whole Farage project.
I think, I mean, part of this is obviously this £5 million that he was given by a crypto investor, and his reasons for doing so was because he said, you know, he needed security, he needed help for security, and I can believe that he has rich friends. He's a city investor. I'm sure he knows lots of millionaires, probably billionaires. He knows Elon Musk. And in the same way that people give money to Mark Collette because they know he's doing good activism, I think the same sort of thing would happen in Nigel circles. And I can understand a friend of him saying, well, here's £5 million. That will sort out your security for the rest of your life. You can continue saying the things that you want and you will have security. So I can believe that that's the truth. And of course, then this week we've also had the murder of Anne Widdecombe. Absolutely horrendous. I mean, Anne Widdecombe, she was a national treasure. I can recall her defending the reason why we don't have Holocaust denial laws in Britain. So the fact that she's gone, I think, is a great shame. She wasn't a far right politician in any sort of sense of the word, but she did speak up for free speech at least. And I thought she was a wonderful woman, to be honest. And now we've just seen her murdered. So I think this sort of bears out the fact that Nigel is going to need security. He needs security, and that money was given to him for that. I believe it. Anyway, what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I can see the point of view that says that Farage needs security. The problem is that his story on all of that has changed so many times. The problem also is £5 million. Buys a hell of a lot of security, and there's evidence to a certain extent that far from being spent on security, it was used so that he could make investments in various fields. It was used for property investments, it was used for share investments, it was used for crypto, all sorts of vaguely spiffy things that we've come to associate with reform. You're quite right, of course, that Anne Widdecombe was sort of the opposite extreme from that sort of spiviness, and that's why she was such a handy person for reform to have on board, because she was someone of obvious sort of personal integrity, even though her views were not our views. Farage, though, there's just, even aside from the fact that his ideology isn't ours, there just seems to me to be this constant sort of, as I say, spiviness about both Farage personally and the people with whom he chooses to surround himself. I'm not going to sort of get you into legal trouble by going into the details of this guy, George Cotterill, no relation of Mark Cotterill and spelled differently. Who has this sort of slightly, well, he has a criminal record. That's a matter of record. And he's another of these people who float around this slightly shady world of crypto dealing. You know, you mentioned, well, if somebody were generous enough to donate to Mark Collett, it would be quite reasonable for him to spend money on security for him and his family. Well, yes, but I rather think that even in Mark Collett's case, if he trousered £5 million from some guy who's resident in Thailand and makes his money in crypto dealing, and then seemed to be prepared to alter PA's policies on issues like crypto in ways that seemed to benefit the guy who'd given the £5 million. I think that the regardless of understandable issues of security and what have you, people would criticise Mark a bit about that. And it, quite frankly, it's not the sort of thing I can imagine Mark Collett doing. I can't imagine him putting PA's policies up for sale, as it were. I also can't imagine Mark Collard sort of literally hiring himself out on some sort of online thing and saying, as Farage did pretty bizarrely a year or two ago, if you remember, he went on one of these, I forget the names of these various online services, but listeners will remember the story. It was one of these things where you can pay a celebrity, and to be honest, it's usually slightly fading celebrities who rent themselves out in this way. But in Farage's case, he joined in on it. And you can pay a celebrity to read out a birthday message for somebody, you know, or just to read out what was said. And sometimes it's some slightly suggestive sort of thing. And the joke is getting somebody to read out these, a famous person to read out these ridiculous words and all sorts of strange slogans he was persuaded to read out. You know, he was persuaded to read out something, a message to somebody that ended in up the RA, meaning up the IRA. And the sort of thing that, frankly, you would have thought a serious leader of a political movement really ought to be above that sort of thing, and not spending his time saying, "Well, bung me £100 and I'll read out this message for you." You just wonder, what are the underlying values of a movement whose leader does this sort of thing and whose leader has an entourage of, well, in the case of George Cottrell, literally convicted criminals with associations with drug dealers, and in other cases, people who just have a slight air of iffiness about them. It's not really the sort of thing that people like, you know, Mark Collett, John Tyndall, Colin Jordan, A.K. Chesterton, you could imagine them doing. But it is very much the sort of thing that Farage seems to, and his type of people seem to enjoy doing. So even aside from ideology and detailed policy, there's just a certain aura, a certain, at worst, a certain smell about the whole reform project for some people, and certainly for me.
Well, it does certainly show that he's not that principled if he's willing to read out whatever he's given on a bit of paper in exchange for money. And if there have been changes to the reforms policy in areas which would benefit this crypto investor, then that is suspicious and it should be investigated. But I did also notice in your review there, you were quite pleased, or you said that it was a good result for Restore, who I think got something like 6.8%. And I've heard other commentators say that, oh, this was an absolutely dreadful result for Restore because Rupert Lowe was expecting to get much, much more than that. But I think you were of the opinion that it was actually quite a good result for a small party, or a party that had only been around for a few months. Do you want to talk a little bit about Restore and why you thought that was a good result?
Yeah, I wouldn't go overboard and say it was a great result. I'd call it a fair to middling result. And I think the reason why, to be honest, though, you're quite right. Restore's leadership, and in particular Rupert Lowe, have only themselves to blame for the fact that some of their critics have sort of pointed the finger and said, and called it a poor result. Because what happened was, of course, that they talked up their chances to an absolutely ridiculous extent. Now, I can see why there's this, it's a sort of American style of politics, of constantly having to be coming out with big talk. And you see this with Donald Trump a lot. It's not something that you used to associate with British politicians at one time, but we've moved towards this American style of what I might call boosterism. That somehow, in order to get people's attention and keep people interested and build up morale, you've constantly got to be coming up with the big talk. But the problem with it is, of course, that it can undermine you if you're clearly unrealistic. And that's why, traditionally in British politics, if anything, people very often used to slightly play down their expectations. And and Andy Burnham himself and Labour, to an extent, did the traditional thing. they must have known from a fairly early stage in that campaign that they were going to win that election fairly easily. But they didn't talk that up. They didn't talk it up and say, we are going to smash reform out of sight and all of this. They constantly stressed this could be a very close result. We think we've a great chance of winning, but we think it could be very close. When they must have known, certainly at least a week or 2 weeks before polling day, that it wasn't going to be close and they're going to win by a mile. So what I would say is, and what I said to some friends well before polling day, anything between, let's say, 5% and 10% for Restore would be, in the circumstances, a pretty good result. Anything less than 5%, they lose that deposit, it would be pretty horrendous. Anything above 10% would be really very good indeed. So to get 6.8, it was a fair to middling decent result. Now, of course, the problem they have is that, as is fairly well known, they had thrown a very big effort to get that 6.8. It realistically, in my mind, however big an effort they put in, they were never going to convince Makerfield's voters that they had a chance of winning. They were never going to convince them, that convince Makerfield's voters, that election was anything other than a two-horse race between Labour and Reform. And in fact, as we knew, it was more or less a one-horse race. It was, but the top two were obviously going to be Labour and Reform. And I don't think any rational voter in Makerfield was ever in any doubt about that. And that clearly creates a tactical difficulty. It's a difficulty that many nationalists have found in the past. It's a difficulty that the BNP's found when standing in an election that seems to be a close election, where there's an obvious tactical vote for another so-called right-wing party. And it was never going to be easy from that point of view for Restore to convince people that they had a great chance. So the only people that were going to vote Restore were people who definitely decided that, come what may, for whatever reason, they were turning their backs on Reform. And in those circumstances, to get 6.8 in, let's face it, a constituency that was a Reform stronghold. You know, it used to be a Labour stronghold, yeah, but it was a constituency, let's not forget, where every single council seat in that constituency elected a Reform councillor as early as the first week of May this year. So within a few weeks of that, for there to be such a big turnaround was pretty remarkable. Problem, as I say, is where do Restore go from here? And in the weeks since that by-election, I think there have been some pretty evident problems, because there's clearly a battle going on among Rupert Lowe's advisers, with some people saying to him, look, in order to take this party to the next stage and to eat into the Reform vote, they're saying you've got to trim your policies in a more moderate direction. You've got to disown some of the radicals, you know, to sort of go into the names of individuals, but we know the types of people, some of them people we know personally, who are on X, on social media, who've pushed Rupert Lowe very hard. People some of them used to be in PA, some of them used to be in Homeland, some from various backgrounds, but they're quite sort of radical racial nationalists. And they've been pushing Rupert Lowe very hard and wanting to argue to the broader racial nationalist movement that we should all get on board with Restore. And in response to the support that they've given to Rupert Lowe, Lowe seems to be, to a certain extent, disowning them, possibly in response to pressure from his inner circle, who knows. So the jury's still very much out on that whole Restore Britain enterprise. Is it going to, as the Americans would say, going to cuck? Is it going to sell out? is it going to be just an ideologically another version of Reform, which is another way of saying a right-wing Tory party, just with a different figurehead? So if as I was hinting earlier on, people find Nigel Farage a bit spivvy, they can go over to Restore without necessarily being all that much more radical. And that seems to be the way some of Rupert Lowe's advisors are pitching things. But really, it must be, if it is going to go that way, it will be desperately disappointing for a number of remigration campaigners online who've hitched themselves to Restore Britain and spent, you know, pretty much day in, day out, spent quite a number of hours every day, mainly online, but also in turning up to Maker Field and turning up to Great Yarmouth, and really sort of attaching their credibility as serious racial nationalists to the idea that Restore Britain really is something different.
Well, I do think
the jury's out on that. We'll see.
Well, I do think, if you look at their policies, they're very good policies, but then you have Rupert Lowe counter-signalling ethno-nationalism, which I think if he was to say, I support ethno-nationalism, that would be political suicide. So I think he does have to be diplomatic. I think you just have to look at these policies. But it also shows that there is discontent with Reform, the fact that Restore did get 6.8%, because they would have all been Reform voters. So, I mean, that shows you've got this discontent. And I guess it's experience, really, that we can put it down to, with Rupert Lowe saying that they were going to get a much higher position than they did. I mean, he is a fairly new member of Parliament. He's only been doing it for a couple of years. And before that, he was doing other things. So I think we can still, I'm not going to condemn Restore. I still support Restore. I still have them on the Radio Albion website. I do think they're the best political outlet for our activism. Well, moving on to the next subject here. You did a review of Sam Melia's book, Legal, Truthful, Guilty, which I thought was a wonderful book. I found it very hard to put down. I actually thought it was very well written, and I was quite surprised at that. I didn't know Sam had any literary ideas at all before this, and yet it was written very, very, very well. It's not written by AI, and the pacing was very good.
Right.
And as I say, I couldn't put it down, and it was very truthful. So what were your thoughts about Sam's book, Peter?
Well, as you'll see in the review, I was very enthusiastic about Sam's book. I thought, as you say, it was a very well written book. It really, really got across to you both the personal sacrifice that he'd made, especially as a family man with a young family, but also his determination and the way that he came through all those pretty horrendous and depressing experiences of being in prison. He didn't allow that to drag him down, by which I mean he didn't allow it to demoralise him. He managed to walk that difficult tightrope in prison. And this is something that comes across several times in the book, that when you're a decent, honest person, whereas most people in prison, obviously, by definition, are not decent, honest people. They're criminals. But if you're a decent, honest person who gets sent to prison, you're walking a tightrope every day between getting dragged into the values of a criminal subculture on the one hand, or else on the other hand, being seen by your fellow inmates as a grass, as a snitch, as someone who's on the side of the authorities. And obviously Sam didn't want to do either, to fall into either of those traps, and that comes across very strongly in the book in terms of the daily life of being in prison. Also comes across is that the sheer outrage of how far we've moved in this country on race laws. You know, going back a few issues in H&D, as you know, quite some time ago, I wrote a multi-part history of the way in which race laws developed in this country and race law cases by analysing papers on some of those cases that are available at the National Archives. And in Sam's case, it made me realise yet again how we've sunk even further. We're not quite in such a bad situation as say, Germany or Austria, that where people like Ursula Haferbeck are locked up in their 90s. But we're heading that way. We're heading that way in terms of the persecution of thoroughly decent people, the persecution of thoroughly decent people just for fighting for their country, just for fighting for political truth. We're not yet at the stage where you can get where you're likely to get imprisoned purely for fighting for historical truth, but we're edging closer to that, as the Vincent Renoir case showed, and certainly Sam's case showed that you can try your best to stay on the right side of the law, and they will still try to catch you. They will still try to jail you. And they will try to break you. They will try to demoralise you. They will try to use your case as an example to the rest of the country to say, don't you even think about daring to challenge the establishment, because we'll throw you in jail. And that's one of the reasons why writing a book like this, that even in these circumstances, is still an optimistic book. That's why I think it's so important, because it's one in the eye for his persecutors, not just personally, that he hasn't been broken by it, but that he's saying to the rest of the country, you shouldn't be broken by it either. You shouldn't be deterred by it either. So, yes, an excellent book.
Yeah, he sets a good example. I mean, one of the pieces there, I think you brought it up in the review as well, is where there's some trouble on the wing, and Sam's instinct is to, there's a fight going on, to tell the prison wardens that there's a fight going on. And of course, that would be his instinct if he was outside of the prison. But of course, in the prison, you're going to get in trouble for doing that. He was very lucky he didn't get in serious trouble with the other prisoners for doing that. They understood that it was, it was because he didn't understand the prison culture, basically, is why he did that. And I think that really shows you what the prisoners are like. You know, I mean, they understood that I wasn't from their world as well. And so long as I didn't get involved in their world, I was absolutely fine. And by what I mean by getting involved in their world is ended up taking drugs or getting yourself in debt. And it's only when people get themselves into debt that they really get themselves into trouble in prison. One of the things that really came across to me is that nobody wants to be in prison. You know, these people didn't make these decisions in their lives thinking they would end up in prison. They made these decisions thinking that they had made the right decision. And a lot of them did not want to go back to prison. And just this week, I was reading some reports of in American prisons, and there seems to be lots and lots of American prisoners that are converting to Christianity, so many of them that there's a news story about it. And that to me says that there's a lot of prisoners that regret the things that they've done and wish to try and put them right. And that's generally what most prisoners are like. And my final piece on this, it was a contrast between the way Sam was treated at the hostel. When I was at the hostel, I didn't have anywhere else to go, and they were constantly saying, oh, you can't stay at the hostel any longer, we're going to have to get you out of the hostel. And with Sam, who had a family to go back to, they were saying, well, we can't let you go to your family, you're going to have to stay here at the hostel for a year. So and that shows you that they're just trying to get under your skin, basically.
Yeah, that's very fascinating, that contrast, isn't it? That whichever way you play it, they're just wanting to try to break you. The sheer lack of sincerity from these people, and this is what's so shocking about it, because all of these do-gooders, you know, most of the time, who associate themselves with social work and rehabilitation of prisoners and all that sort of thing, you know, with some pretty ghastly criminals, they're prepared to bend over backwards to be do-gooders with these people. And yet when it comes to people like us, when it comes to racial nationalists, they're out to break you, not to help you in any way, shape, or form. They're there to put obstacles in your path. It really shows the cynicism that lies behind the woke do-goodery.
That shows you the political nature, basically, of the reason why you're there. The other prisoners can't understand why you're treated so seriously when all you've done is speak against immigration or use an old-fashioned word. I mean, they couldn't believe the reason why I was in there. So you do get treated differently. I got treated quite well by the prisoners that I was with in there. Well, the next subject that comes up here, we've got a couple of subjects, really. We've got another book review, The Roots of the British, and I purchased a copy of that earlier this year. I don't know if I mentioned it on the last episode or not, Peter. I thought it was a very good book, but there was it's quite clear in it that there were migrations and there were people moving around Europe from one part of Europe to another, white people moving, basically, and he accepts that. And then there's DNA evidence which shows that people from what's now Turkey, Asia Minor, made their way into Britain. And as far as I know, they brought blue eyes and blonde hair with them. But he says, well, this can't be because they were Asian. And I thought, that's a bit of a silly thing to say, because obviously there were white people in Asia at that time. It wasn't Turks that were actually living in Asia Minor back then. So the fact that they say that Asian or people from Asia came over, they're effectively saying that it was white people that came over. And that to me seemed a bit of a silly mistake to make. But apart from that, I thought it was an excellent book. What were your thoughts?
Yes, I think the important thing about Steve's book and Kevin's review of Steve's book is that it's from a scientific perspective, revisiting a work that Steve produced decades ago, revisiting it in the light of changing scientific evidence, changing new discoveries, especially in relation to DNA, but also archaeological discoveries as well. And the most essential point is that everybody in racial nationalism has traditionally been confronted with the multiracialist argument saying, Britain is a nation of migrants. But also, they put an extra spin on that and say, Britain is a nation of mongrels, as though to be a nation that's had waves of migration is that synonymous with being racially mongrelized. The point of Steve's book is that he makes clear that's not the case. He makes clear that yes, there were waves of migration, but these are waves of migration of Europeans, not of, even if they're from what might be geographically termed Asia today, they are racial Europeans, successive waves of racial European migrants. And it's difficult to do justice in a few minutes to a work of such complexity, but I recommend all of your listeners to acquire this and to study this, and also to look for updates in the years to come from Steve about this, in the light of all the new evidence that keeps coming along, because we shouldn't be afraid of responding directly to our critics who are what you might call science deniers. These are the people not only that deny the existence of genders, deny gender differences, and want to imagine there are any number of genders, deny science in that respect. These are people who are prepared to undermine and traduce the reputation of eminent scientists, of Nobel Prize winners, of people with half a century or more of scientific achievement, and they will traduce them often late in their lives or even after their deaths, and want their names removed from college buildings, etc., simply because such people refuse to fall in line with fashionable lies about race. simply because these people maintained a spirit of scientific inquiry, a spirit of honest scientific inquiry on racial matters, both before the new discoveries related to DNA and after. By contrast, people like Steve are constantly revising their views in the light of new discoveries. And that's what science is all about. Not insisting that you have to fall into line with some fashionable doctrine, or else you'll lose your post, or you'll literally suffer iconoclasm. Your statue will be torn down. Your name will be removed. It's a bit like used to happen in ancient Rome. You've probably heard of these occasions where, if an emperor had been overthrown or disgraced, people would chisel out the inscriptions. Or in Stalin's Russia, if somebody had been disgraced and thrown out of the party, they would literally alter the photograph, sometimes quite crudely, and would just scribble out in the age before Photoshop, or cut out people from photographs where they'd been standing next to Comrade Stalin. This is what happens to scientists nowadays, and it's not people that have made a their living in politics, where you might say, well, in politics it's all fair game, but people that are just trying to be honest scientists or honest historians, and they get targeted by the woke mob. And so the book that that Steve came out with is an important and detailed riposte to all of that, and provides vast amounts of ammunition that we can use to fight back against our enemies, and not least people who have school-aged children. People in our movement who have school-aged children, and their children are subjected to brainwashing in schools and colleges. I think a book like Roots of the British is an important resource for resisting that type of brainwashing that's applied even sometimes to members of our own families.
I think universities wouldn't even get funding to do research unless it's going to show what is in line with their politically correct ideas in the first place. They won't even fund it. And I think the peoples that came to Britain were all very, very closely related brother nations, is how I would describe them, as brothers, essentially, not people from sub-Saharan Africa or people from the subcontinent of Asia and India, but closely related European peoples. And the next subject that's covered is possibly my favorite bit, actually, and it's the Australian history, because this is all new to me, and it's all very interesting, because of course Australia had the White Australia policy, specifically a White Australia policy, and it was started off with criminals, and then these criminals squatted the land and they became farmers, and there was another group that was trying to purchase the land, and they had these battles between them, and this fellow Ned Kelly, his name is quite famous, but I didn't really know much about him, and it's the third part in that series, and I do recommend that series because it is very interesting. What did you think of this series on Australia? I mean, it's still halfway through, Peter. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think for two points I'd make about that. First of all, that Jack Van Tongeren, one of our oldest subscribers, a veteran Australian racial nationalist, has done a tremendous job in that, in bringing home to people in the broader Anglosphere things that are histories that aren't familiar to people outside of Australia. I think it's always been an important part of H&D's mission to be a magazine not just for British people, but for people throughout the Anglosphere who share not only a common racial heritage, but share a common political struggle in defence of that heritage. But I also think that that this series about Australia also in particular bears out how our struggle, our pro-white struggle, is in so many ways the genuine working class struggle. And you mentioned Ned Kelly, and this series has emphasized time and again how Australia was built not only by white people, but, you know, a lot of the time the left try to portray imperialism and try to portray whites as though we've got to be guilty because we were the privileged people. We were in some sense, some highly privileged caste that was going out and dominating the rest of the world and exploiting, using our privilege to exploit people in the rest of the world. Now, of course, this series about the white Australians shows it's very much the opposite. These people that built up Australia, these people that built up white Australia, were very, very far from being privileged people. And one could extend that argument into broader politics as well, and say that in the 2020s, especially now, in all parts of the white world, the people who are being exploited are, again, it's white people who are the victims of exploitation, and that multiracialism, mass immigration, is something that's being driven by the exploitative machine of international capitalism. That mass immigration is the latest way of victimizing white workers, not only by holding down their wages, by holding down their working conditions, depressing their working conditions, by invading their homeland, by invading the very parts of their homeland where the least well-off white people live. In all of these ways, white workers are the people that really are the being betrayed by the left, and are the natural base for racial nationalist parties, whether those are political parties or non-electoral movements, people seeking to rebuild white society one way or another, whether that's as a form of electoral resistance or in any other way. So yeah, I think Jack's article really underlines not only from an Australian historical point of view, but from let's say, an international white working class point of view. So people that are coming to our movement from the left, from a quasi-Marxist position, I think should read articles like Jack's as part of their conversion process, part of their deprogramming away from Marxism, part of their recognition that racial nationalism is the true cause of the workers.
I guess it could be said that sort of tearing up the white underclass basically from their homeland and transporting them to the other side of the world in chains, it mirrors the story that we're told about the Atlantic slave trade and the black Africans that were trapped, put in chains, taken to America, forced to work on farms. You had exactly the same thing there happening with white people. You know, they were put in chains, transported to the other side of the world, forced to work effectively, and they built this amazing country at the end of it. And maybe people should make more of a point there of how that mirrors it. But we've got other articles there. There's The Principles of Nationalism, which I haven't read just yet. You've got From the Other Side of the Pond, Why I Am a Christian Nationalist. I'm looking forward to reading that as well. You've got Reader's Letters, Movement News. We haven't got the time to get into any of those, but if people purchase an edition of Heritage and Destiny, they can read about them themselves. We've just got a few minutes to go, Peter. Do you want to tell us what you're working on at the moment, or what we can expect in the next issue, or at your own website?
Well, at the moment, I'm continuing to work on the latest episode in on a detailed website history related to the Cambridge spy ring and to Kim Philby and the Cambridge spy ring, because, and that ultimately will a version of that will come out in print. But essentially the bottom line on that is that I'm looking at the various aspects of the Cambridge spy ring to show how the true story of that infamous espionage scandal has been systematically suppressed, and in particular that the fact that right the way back in the early 1960s, when the first Soviet defector pointed to the existence of such a spy ring, he said in words that have been written out of history, but that we can now put back into history where they belong. He said that there was something fundamentally Jewish about that Cambridge spy ring. Now, we need to look in detail as to what he meant, because obviously none of those five Englishmen were Jews themselves. Two of them were married to Jewesses at one time, but none of them were Jews. But in what precise way did that defector Gallitzin, what did he mean by a fundamental underlying Jewish aspect to the Cambridge spy ring? It was something that the authorities definitely took notice of at the time. This wasn't some conspiracy theory thing. It was something absolutely fundamental to the investigation at the beginning. And I'm looking in detail as to exactly what did that mean. What were the specifically Jewish aspects of communist subversion from the 1930s through the 1940s into the 1950s? What was the relationship between Soviet communism and Zionism? What was the relationship between the KGB and the Zionist intelligence services? And what types of subversion were going on, and what lessons can we learn from looking at it?
I thought they were Jewish. So you're saying they weren't Jewish. The Cambridge spy ring, they weren't Jewish, but they were married to Jewesses. Because I thought they were the descendants, or they were themselves Jewish refugees. I'm wrong in thinking that, am I?
Not the actual Cambridge spies themselves, by which I mean, to be clear, Burgess MacLean, Philby, Blunt and Cairncross. Those five people who are regarded as the five members of the Cambridge spy ring. Now, naturally, they had... It's been well known for a long time that they had particular connections with Victor Rothschild, Lord Rothschild. It's been known for a long time that a couple of the Soviet intelligence officers who recruited them and ran them, and who weren't themselves at Cambridge, that they were Jews. But the particular nature of the particular Jewish aspects to those five individuals and to their work goes way beyond what we'd previously known about the Rothschild connection and about these Jewish KGB officers. It goes a long way beyond that, and I've demonstrated this in the initial articles about Cairncross and how he worked with European Jewish arms dealers in relation to the Spanish Civil War, and that aspect of his work was absolutely fundamental to what he was doing in the 30s, much more than has been accepted by previous historians. And I've looked at Kim Philby, both in relation to his first wife, Litzy Friedman, and in relation to the very curious story that I've already written about now, Kim Philby's father, St. John Philby, very much an Englishman, very much associated with the British Raj in India, became right-hand man to Ibn Saud, the founder of Saudi Arabia, and became an Arabian explorer, an expert on Arabia, and regarded by historians as a sort of a pro-Arab anti-Semite, if you like. But St. John Philby spent a large part of the 1930s as an intermediary between Ibn Saud and Zionist intelligence, an intermediary in particular between Ibn Saud and Chaim Weizmann, the first president of the State of Israel, and then the leader of the World Zionist Movement, in various secret negotiations between the leader of what the founder of Saudi Arabia and the first president of Israel, and what's truly extraordinary is that before the war, one of these secret negotiations, St. John Philby and top Zionist leaders meeting in a meeting for lunch in a London club, with the young Kim Philby himself actually sitting down as part of this elite lunch party, discussing the highest level of Zionist Arab secret negotiation. And this was the very time that Kim Philby was starting his work for the KGB. So the extent to which Zionist espionage, Zionist subversion, and Soviet espionage were sort of all mixed up together is very, very visible indeed in the case of Philby with his father, St. John Philby. And the next part of the story, I'm just about to publish, looks at the relationship between Philby and another prominent Zionist, Teddy Kollek, very important Zionist intelligence operative during and after the Second World War, later the long-serving mayor of Jerusalem, and the very particular way in which Teddy Kollek, as a Zionist spy, even before Mossad existed, was close to Philby and close to the highest levels of the nascent CIA. So that's the next exciting episode.
Well, I certainly look forward to reading that. That sounds absolutely fascinating. Peter, I'm very grateful for you for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.